I'm Alan Saunders. Welcome to the Comfort Zone. And welcome to an exquisitely handcrafted one-off edition of Radio National's weekly look at architecture and design, food and landscape. We might be so far into the machine age these days that we've got machines designing machines that make other machines, but there are some people out there for whom the potter's wheel is about as much technology as they want to let into their lives. In the beginning, of course, everything was handmade. But despite the promise of the machine age, in 19th century England and America, the Industrial Revolution also led, in certain quarters, to a deeply rooted intellectual mistrust of the effect of the machine on society. People's homes were being furnished not by the carefully handcrafted and one-off, but by the mass-produced. And out of a feeling that the demise of good craftsmanship meant the demise of something important in society, the arts and crafts movement was born. Well, to discuss the values that underpinned this movement and how, from its origins in the United Kingdom, it spread to the United States and Australia, I'm joined in our Melbourne studio by Harriet Edquist, head of the School of Architecture and Design at RMIT, who's currently working on a book about one of Australia's arts and crafts architects. And we're joined on the line from Lambertville, New Jersey, by David Rago, who, through his auction companies and publications, has become an expert on the ceramics, furniture, and other household items produced by the American arts and crafts movement. Welcome, both of you, to Radio National's The Comfort Zone.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you.
David, let's begin with the origins of the movement. There are two people, two polymaths, who were essential to the birth of the arts and crafts movement in the UK, weren't there? There was William Morris, who was a poet, an artist, and an architect, and John Ruskin, who was also an artist as well as an art historian and a social commentator.
Well, I can tell you more about the impact that Morris and Ruskin had on the Americans than I can tell you about the impact they had on the Europeans, because my expertise pretty much starts at around 1890, long after they'd done their work. What I can tell you is that some key American exponents, such as Elbert Hubbard and Gustav Stickley, traveled to Europe to either meet these people or see the work they did, and they were greatly influenced by them, and they came back with this creative spark and developed the arts and crafts movement in America.
Harriet, when Americans, or I suppose for that matter Australians, went to Europe to see Morris, what sort of person did they see? What sort of person was he? What were his concerns?
Well, I think it depends when they went to see him. Towards the end of his life, of course, he'd become a very radical socialist philosopher and public speaker. So had they gone in the 1880s, for example, they would have seen a very dynamic public figure who was arguing the values of socialism, and in fact he turned some of Ruskin's writings around to reproduce them for the socialist movement. For example, one chapter of a very famous book Ruskin wrote called The Stones of Venice, a chapter in that Morris republished called The Nature of Gothic, which really argued for the reintroduction of handwork, of, I suppose, a love of labour, of a re-engagement of the worker with their work, which had been destroyed during the Industrial Revolution. So they would have seen a very socialist Morris in the 1880s.
That seems to imply that this desire to get back to what has been made by hand had a very distinct moral and indeed political dimension to it.
Yes, it did. And it wasn't just Morris. I mean, the sort of ethical dimension of it had happened earlier in Britain with a figure called Augustus Welby Northmore Pugin,
whom we celebrated on this show last year, because there's a lot of Pugin in Australia.
Absolutely. He was extremely important in the Gothic revival in Australia. And but he was. He was one of the first people to introduce this notion that medieval or Christian architecture, as he called it, was moral architecture, was ethical architecture, because it spoke for a period that had integrated social life with its art. And Ruskin wrote round about the same time and was probably influenced by Pugin, although he didn't like to say so. So this sort of notion of the morality or the ethical basis of the arts and crafts movement was quite a long-standing one, and started in at least the 1830s or 40s.
Interesting to hear you talk about the moral imperative of arts and crafts coming from that perspective. My understanding was that it had the moral imperative in the sense that it was a process-oriented aesthetic, and that as people were engaged in the process of creating, they found within themselves more spirit, and the objects they were working on were imbued with that sense of spirit. And to me, that's where the spiritual underpinnings of the arts and crafts movement came from, being involved in the creative process.
Well, this implies, David, doesn't it, that anything made by machine must be inferior in quality, perhaps in spiritual quality, to something that's handmade?
Unquestionably.
There's a problem, though, isn't there, that handmade objects aren't cheaper than machine-made objects, so the arts and crafts movement, in financial terms at least, it's going to be somewhat elitist, isn't it?
Well, certainly that's the way it worked out in Europe. I think it originally intended to be available to the masses, and it turned out to be a rather elitist material. I think the idea of the Americans was to make it more democratic, and Gustav Stickley did this a number of ways. Even though it was handmade furniture, it was made within the walls of a factory, so there was some mass production involved. It was a compromise, as Americans are wont to do.
So, David, you've got furniture made, handmade perhaps, but within a factory in the US. But what about machines? Was there a place in the US arts and crafts movement for the machine?
Especially in America, that would be true. I mean, we had been taught long ago that the Europeans eschewed the machine in every which way, and my understanding recently is that that's not entirely true. The machine was used to some extent in the arts and crafts movement. In the U.S., the idea, as I understand it from Gustav Stickley's workshop, was get a sawmill to mill a tree down so you don't have two guys with a handsaw working all day. Use the machine for the less appealing aspects of the work, but when it comes down to the design and the fitting and the detailing, that should all be done by hand.
I just would like to concur with David that, in fact, the Australian experience is very like the American one. And although in the 1880s people were talking about Morris and Ruskin and so forth, and during the 1890s, very soon Australians became much more aware of what was happening in America. And Stickley and the Craftsman magazine, as soon as it came out, was known in Australia, and you start getting very craftsman-oriented work. And in Melbourne, certainly, the arguments around 1900 that they were having about this did in fact support the notion that you could use industry. And some of the English designers like Ashby and so forth did also say, yes, use industry for the difficult things and release the craftsperson for the other things. So I think the Australian experience is in fact very parallel to the American one, and what it was about was democratic architecture and democratic design.
David, can I get a sense from you of what range of objects we're talking about? Presumably we're talking about furniture, but does it extend beyond furniture?
Well, I use the word ideally a lot when talking about arts and crafts, because it was an idealistic movement, but it was supposed to touch upon all aspects of our lives, from anything from textiles and architecture and landscaping and furniture and ceramics and stained glass to the books you read and the way those books were printed. It was a life-altering philosophy in its most ideal sense.
And is there behind it a dislike of what we might think of these days as being Victorian, heavily ornamented interiors and furniture, an appeal for a return to something simpler?
Oh, they were pretty blunt about that. The idea, it's not just they didn't like it, they just felt that there wasn't any soul in it. I mean, the idea, if you see a Gustav Stickley Morris chair, which is his standard piece. It's an adjustable back, large armchair that you can sit back and watch TV in. Okay, that's your basic pleasure model for Stickley furniture, and they're straight wood. I mean, there's hardly a curve on them. There's no carved lion's heads. There's no fancy gadgets. It's flat arms and slatted under the arms and very straightforward. But what they did for them was that decoration became the elements of design and the elements of construction. For example, quartered oak was used, virgin growth, American, New York State, Adirondack quartered oak, and it was cut in a way where this extravagant tiger striped grain became decoration, but it was integral to the piece. When the leg ended up through the top of the arm, it ended in a through tenon, and that was an exposed structural detail. And on one hand, it was a very, very strong joint that kept the chair together. On the other hand, it was revealing itself to you. This is how I am made. This is how I come together. And there was no mystery to it. It was meant to be very upfront. So it's a long answer to your question, but you're seeing how what was essential to the construction became an integral part of the design, and it revealed the philosophy as well.
Harriet, what sort of influence did the arts and crafts movement have on domestic architecture?
It had a considerable influence in Australia, although it's not one that has been recognised, I think, nearly as widely as it should have been. From about the 1890s, or late 1880s, 1890s, we can see certain architects moving away from their architecture, which was influenced by people like Norman Shaw in England, towards a much simpler, much more refined and domestically oriented architecture. In Melbourne and Sydney we can find that. By 1900, the influence of people like Stickley and major second generation arts and crafts architects like people like McIntosh and Voysey had begun to be felt, and you get houses particularly which are very simple in form. You get the development of the Craftsman Bungalow, which is a Stickley innovation. Great big roofed houses with open plans. I mean, the plans are very modern. And I would argue that it's in this development of the arts and crafts house that we see the beginning of the modern movement in Australia. And the key arts and crafts architects are the sort of the precursors of the modern movement.
Well, you've been working on a book, Harriet, called Harold Desbrow Anea, A Life in Architecture, which is to be published by Melbourne University Press this May. What role did he play? He was an architect. What role did he play in the arts and crafts movement?
It was an interesting role. He taught at the Melbourne Technical College for about 14 years, which is now RMIT, where I am. And in 1900, he established the T-Square Club. The name came, in fact, from an American club in Philadelphia. And in that club, it was really like one of the craftsman guilds that the British had put together, insofar as it comprised architects, painters, stained glass artists, metal workers, all the sorts of people he could bring together, because he had a very wide range of friends and acquaintances. And they met and conducted competitions and discussions and went out to visit industry and so forth. And that really was the very first arts and crafts society or guild in the country. And a number of his peers recognised the fact that he was instrumental, really, I think, in shaping the movement, certainly in Melbourne. And I think we can see that there are certain architects, famous architects in Melbourne, who were shaped by that experience of joining the T-Square Club.
This is a question really to both of you. Does the arts and crafts movement live on today in any form other than as a subject of historical inquiry and, of course, of interest, something that is of interest to collectors? Do we see the spirit living on at all? David, what would you say?
Unquestionably, and in fact, it's changed America, I think, for good. The whole idea of technical schools and arts and crafts classes in elementary schools and high schools, these to me are all vestiges of what the arts and crafts movement, the changes the arts and crafts movement wrought in America. I think the whole, or not the whole thing, but certainly a major part of the crafts movement after World War II is directly linked to the way arts and crafts changed ideas about what good design was and what participation in process became.
Harriet, what about this country?
I'd completely agree with David on that. And from an architectural point of view, I think if you look at the architecture of the 60s and 70s, I think that it's almost like a continuous development of the arts and crafts movement. I mean, back to nature, expressing structure, which was a fundamental of the arts and crafts that David's mentioned, that you structure becomes a decorative element. If you look at the architecture of the 60s and 70s, you find that. And you also find this extremely interesting influence of Japan, which again was part of the original arts and crafts movement. I mean, Japanese design, Japanese architecture became very important in freeing up the plan and simplifying the house. And you find that again in the 60s and 70s. So, yes, I would say that it has had a profound effect on the 20th century, undoubtedly.
If I can add something to what Harry just said, too, an interesting combination. You might be familiar with the work of George Nakashima, who worked near, 5 miles from where I'm sitting as I speak with you, and he was post-World War II, a Japanese man working in America, but his work was very arts and crafts in the traditional American sense and also very Menge movement as well, but it had a very modern twist to it. He let the materials speak for themselves, joinery was exposed, and he believed in letting the soul of the tree express itself.
It's a lovely phrase.
Yeah.
Finally, Harriet, what lesson can we learn from the arts and crafts movement, especially about the value of the handmade object? What can we take away from it?
I think it has to do with the directness between the way you live in the space that you live in and that sort of relationship. And I think people are, at the moment, are quite disengaged with their environment. And I think the arts and crafts really re-engages you with your total environment. And that seems to me to be important. And it has a very direct, as I say, relationship between the human being and the dwelling. And that one, I would say, would be the key.
Well, Harriet Edquist from RMIT and David Rago, thank you very much indeed for joining us in our exploration of the arts and crafts movement.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
On Radio National, you're with The Comfort Zone.